Later. Okay, Goethe. Yeah. What was that? More closer, exactly. More intimate, that's right. Closing in. That means you're coming closer to ordination, you see? That's what it means, yeah. Okay. Okay, very good. So, let us continue. Is there any questions now before we start up? Because we've been doing all kind of stuff. Everybody happy? At the back, okay. At the back there.
Bhante, how to abandon the sloth and torpor? This is the main problem during the meditation. And then, just now you explained the doubt is about the what mindset are we in? Is it good or bad? I don't quite understand this because when I feel peace and calm, then that is a good mindset.
What is a good mindset?
Because you explained just now the doubt is. I doubt that is the mind state now is good or bad.
Yeah.
I think it's quite clear to me. Can you give more example on this?
On doubt?
Yeah.
Okay. So that doubt itself is not, it's only bad in a certain context, right? You have to understand the context. And the context is all important here. So if you have doubts about the Buddhist teachings and you want to ask and you want to resolve the issues, that kind of doubt is always positive because you're trying to find out what the teachings are about, you're moving towards a resolution. But the context here is a context of meditation, it's a context of coming to samadhi, right? And if you are trying to get into samadhi but don't really understand which mind states are good and which ones are bad, then that is blocking you from entering into samadhi. So it's only in the context of deep meditation that this is a problem. Yeah, that's why they call hindrances.
For example, which mind state are you?
Well, let's say that you are sitting in meditation and you're not aware that there is a very refined desire there going on in the mind. You're not even aware that it's going on. You're not aware that you are pushing your meditation a little bit by using willpower, that kind of thing. So these are the refined kind of things that will stop you from going all the way into the meditation. Maybe there's a slight kind of little things, like it's a tiny amount of restlessness. It feels like you're perfectly still, but actually you're not perfectly still. There's a little bit of things going on there. It feels like your mind is really clear, but there's a little bit of sloth there, perhaps it isn't 100% clear. And to understand those things actually is very difficult because you're not even used to thinking in those terms. Usually you think, oh, now my mind is so clear, I can read, I can study, I can do whatever. But actually you haven't seen the very, very refined aspects of these things. That's what is meant by this. Understand? Sort of? Maybe? Yeah? Okay. Thank you. It's not, what we have to do is you just investigate, and as you investigate, you see what's going on there. That's kind of the idea behind this.
The sloth and torpor also.
Okay, so sloth and torpor. So I was actually going to talk about that afterwards because this is part of what the five hindrances, an important aspect of the five hindrances, as you say. One of the kind of very common thing is that people who meditate, either they think or they have sloth and torpor. There's nothing in between, right? You're thinking away here. So this is part of the problem. But one of the things about the five hindrances that is important to understand is that the first two hindrances are by far the most important ones. They are the ones that kind of lead to everything else. Because if you have desire, then the mind tends to be restless, it tends to be agitated. And if you have desire, it also tends to tire out the mind after a while. Desire makes, because there's so much agitation and things involved in that, so it tires the mind out. So it leaves a sense of sloth in the mind very easily. So the first two hindrances, if you're able to deal with desire and also with ill will to a very large extent, the other three hindrances tend to fall away as a consequence. So that is the most important thing. So instead of actually working with the sloth and torpor and trying to overcome that directly, instead work on the sense desire and the ill will, and then gradually you feel, oh, it's disappearing, it's going away, and then you're kind of heading in the right direction. Otherwise, you can try to overcome sloth and torpor forever, and nothing really happens because the other hindrances are holding it up and stabilizing it, basically. Okay. Anybody else wants to say anything? No. Okay. Good. So, I got so many drinks here, I can barely fit them on the table. It's very sweet, very, very nice. Okay, so let us continue on the same paragraph. So this is the paragraph on the five hindrances in the gradual training, page 15, second last paragraph on page 15. And these five hindrances are obviously quite important. There are things that you see in the suttas in so many different contexts, in so many different areas. But they tend to only occur in this particular place in the suttas, just before you are about to enter the jhanas. The next paragraph is about entering into the jhana states. And after you have done the sense restraint, after you have done the clear awareness or full awareness of things, that's usually where the abandoning of the five hindrances occurs. And that tells you something about what it really is all about, because it always in the same place, right? And also after you have kind of gone to an empty spot and you're sitting down to do your meditation practice, that is where these things happen. So what that means is that this happens in the same place on the path where normally you find meditation practice, normally where you find the satipatthanas, normally where you find mindfulness of breathing and all of these other kind of things. So what this really is, and this is important because it's very hard to understand, okay, five hindrances, how it doesn't say anything about how to overcome them. It just says you abandon these five hindrances. So how it is done, and once you understand the place this has on the path, that is the same place as the meditation, as satipatthana, you realize that this actually happens through the meditation practice. That is what actually abandons these things, right? Satipatthana practice itself, just staying with the breath or whatever it is, that is what abandons these five hindrances. And that is an important point, because otherwise it is actually, there's no guidance here as to how these hindrances are actually overcome. And this is then how you do that. So what is also interesting about this, we have been talking all along about the restraint of the senses, about the full awareness and all of these kind of things. And all the way through, there has been an emphasis on abandoning bad states of mind, especially sense desire and also ill will. This has been kind of one of the crucial things here up until now. And then suddenly, you still have to abandon the five hindrances, right? The five hindrances are still there. So what is going on here? How come we have been talking so much about overcoming sense desire and ill will, and now suddenly we still have to overcome the five hindrances? What's the story here? And what is happening is that, remember that when we abandon the defilements of the mind, it all happens stage-wise. It happens one thing after the other. You start with a more coarse aspect of the five of the defilements, move on to the middling aspects, and then you move to the refined aspects. So what we're seeing here is a gradual movement on removing the more and more refined aspects of the defilements of the mind. And this is what the five hindrances represent in the suttas. What they represent is the most refined aspect of the defilements before you enter into samadhi. So this is important to understand, because very often we talk about the five hindrances as a catch-all for all kind of defilements of the mind, but actually it refers really only to the most refined aspect of the defilements just before we're about to enter samadhi. That is what they really are about. And that's why in the suttas we find that the hindrances are often called the upakilesa. Upakilesa means something like a refined hindrance, basically. That's what it refers to. What is the translation? I read somewhere else. That was quite a nice one. what was it again now? Imperfection, that's right, imperfections of the mind. So the mind isn't quite perfect yet, right? Almost perfect mind. It's nice to have a perfect mind, but there's little imperfections kind of lurking there, trying to kind of throw you off track. And these last imperfections, these are the things called the upakilesa. And there is, in fact, a whole sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 128, called the Upakilesa Sutta, the imperfections of the mind, is what that sutta is about. And that is all about these refined little things that stop you from kind of going all the way into samadhi. So this is what this is about. And then you can see why it fits into the path with Satipatthana, with mindfulness of breathing, and all of these kind of things. Because I've been mentioning before, Satipatthana practice is precisely about getting rid of these final defilements of the mind. And so is mindfulness of breathing itself. Once you do those practices, these things tend to go out of the window. That's the idea anyway. That's the kind of what we're trying to do with these things. So here we are dealing with right sati, sammasati. We have now moved from sammapadana, right effort. We're moving into sammasati. So how come these defilements are abandoned when we do satipatthana practice? When you watch the breath, how come these defilements disappear? Right, and what the reason that one of the reasons they disappear is because defilements always need to be fed by something. If you are going to have sensory desire for something, if you're going to kind of think about food, oh, you really not now after the meal, but before the meal, right? When you're still very hungry, you think about food, oh, all this beautiful food, and the reason why that desire is then keeps on going is because you keep thinking about the food. But if you change your attention instead to the breath and you can stay with the breath, then of course that desire will die down because you're no longer feeding it. It has to be fed to kind of be kept up. The only way that anger, ill will and desire is going to sustain itself is you feed it by contemplating that object that gives rise to the desire, that gives rise to the anger. Yeah, otherwise, if you keep on watching the breath, oh, all of these things, they die down gradually. And in the place, you get the energy, you get the mindfulness, and all of these other things arising instead, until it's completely gone. So, that is how this idea of abandoning the five hindrances here, roughly how it works, and that is what its function here is on the path, the very end there, how to abandon these things. Samma sati is what we are coming, what we're looking at now, essentially. So, those are the five hindrances, the two first ones being the most important, and the rest kind of happening, disappearing as part of the course, usually. Okay, so let us move on to the next sutta. Everybody happy with the five hindrances? Am I saying anything that makes sense to anyone? Anything making? Yeah, okay, great. Sometimes you don't know, you just talk and have no idea whether anyone actually can really, you know, make any sense of what you're saying, but that's always very useful. So now we are going on to page 44. And this is another way of looking at the five hindrances in terms of some similes again. Always these similes of the Buddha, very useful and very powerful. So, okay. The longer discourse at Astapura is this one. It has all this particular sutta. It also has the gradual training, all the practice, all the way from the time you go forth under the Buddha, all the way to the end. But this sutta also has a lot of nice similes at the same time. And these are some of the similes for the five hindrances. Bhikkhus, suppose a man were to take out a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed, so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there would be enough extra to maintain a wife. Then, I guess in those days that's the way things were. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Or suppose a man were afflicted and suffering and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from the affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain strength. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. Actually, let me stop there. Let's have a look at these similes a little bit, because they are not very common similes, but there is a little bit of interest, I think, in these ones. So here again, you have this idea of taking out a loan, right? We saw before how in that sutta called, what is it called? Yeah, Potalia Sutta, where they talk about borrowed goods, the things that you take out in the world, the sensual pleasures, the sensual things you have are all like borrowed goods. So it's all like taking out a loan. And of course, once you take out a loan, not only do you have to repay the loan, you have to pay interest as well, right? That's the problem with loans. So it's always extra to be paid. And this is, I think, very similar to what we saw in that sutta, is when you attach to things, you do things, not only do you have to repay it when you give it up, but very often you have to pay the extra interest, the attachment, the mental pain that comes as a consequence of having attached to something. Yeah. So there's always bad news, the sensual pleasures in this way. Yeah. And we know that debt has to be repaid one day. There's not much choice about that. We know the interest has to be paid as well. Huh? So here the idea is that then you undertake some business, and your business succeeds. And this would perhaps here then be like meditation practice, the Noble Eightfold Path. So your practice of the Noble Eightfold Path succeeds, and then there is enough money to left over to maintain a wife. I'm not sure exactly what that is supposed to mean here, how it actually fits in, but maybe it means that on top of your meditation succeeding, you get some extra insight. Maybe the wife here is about insight. I'm really not sure. Maybe that's what it's referring to. Huh? And then when you think about that, right, you consider, you think, whoa, you are so glad and full of joy. Huh? And of course, this is the point here, is that not only in the worldly life do you become happy when you repay the loans, because loans are always kind of oppressive. The loan, the lender is kind of around the corner to claim back his money or whatever it is. But also on the loan of the sensual desire, when you abandon that, you always feel glad and joyful as a consequence. And this is one of the most important consequences of abandoning the five hindrances, is that it leads to happiness, right? You feel joyful about it. It leads to the mindfulness, of course, because you're abandoning these forces that drive you into the future, that agitate the mind, and all these kind of things. So because of that, happiness is a natural consequence of abandoning these defilements. So you can see here, now we talked about the earlier on the gradual training, how it leads to the happiness of blamelessness, right? Then we have the unsullied happiness, and now we have the happiness that comes from abandoning the defilements completely here. Yeah, one happiness after the other, bliss upon bliss upon bliss, is really the kind of the Buddhist path here. And then we have the simile of anger. And here you are kind of suffering and gravely ill, is what anger is about. So it's like considered a very serious affliction of the mind. And the reason why you are gravely ill and suffering is because it is a state of suffering itself. And of course, because you are also gravely, it's like mentally ill. The Buddha talks about this elsewhere, because you cannot see things straight at all. And you think what is right is wrong and what is wrong is right. And you act on that, and that is essentially what goes on when you get angry and ill will. Even a little bit of ill will is going to distort reality for you. Remember that. These things are, we're talking about very subtle forms of ill will here, right? Subtle forms of desire. And even a slight little bit of these things is going to distort your reality and make things difficult for you. Huh? So even a little bit of ill will is no good, let alone medium, let alone lots of ill will, like rage and whatever. Huh? So, and of course, then he says here, the food would not agree with him, and his body would and he was feeling weak, and his food doesn't agree with him. So I guess this is a bit like that. Angry. If you're angry, you kind of tend to enjoy less. Life is just less satisfactory. Things are less enjoyable. You can't really enjoy your surroundings so much. In exactly the same way, if you have anger, then you cannot really enjoy what is going on. Of course, and then when you let go of all that, no more anger, again, you feel glad and full of joy as a consequence. Okay, let's move on to the other ones then. Or suppose a man were imprisoned in a prison house, but later he would be released from prison, safe and secure, with no loss to his property. Then on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. So, prison house here is the sloth and torpor, the tiredness and lethargy. It's like you are locked, you cannot get out of it, right? You know what it's like when you feel sloth and torpor? You're locked inside of yourself, you have no clarity, you cannot see anything clearly when that is the case. So it is a serious problem, of course. And then, when you are released with no loss to your property, again, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but it might mean that in this case, we haven't really made any bad karma, right? Karma is our property, karma, we're heir to our karma, etc. You haven't really made any bad karma. So when you come out of that jail of sloth and torpor, you still have your spiritual qualities intact, and then you can keep on practicing as a consequence. That might be the meaning here. I'm not entirely so sure about these similes, because they are not similes that are all that common, but that is just a guess what is going on. Or suppose a man were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where he wants, but later on he would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others, a freed man, able to go where he wants. Then, on considering this, he would again be glad and full of joy. And of course, slavery here is basically the restlessness, right? And as we have seen before, we have been talking about being a slave to craving. Of course, one of the main aspects of craving is precisely the kind of restlessness and agitation that you have. So that slavery is very closely related, the slavery of restlessness and craving here. And you are a slave because it's the craving which is in charge. It wants you to run here and there. The restlessness in charge. If you try to stop it, if you try to kind of just sit down, it feels terrible and you have to start running again. So somebody's like whipping you over the back and say, run, okay, master. And then you kind of run where the craving kind of tells you to go. I think it's a very apt simile, the idea of being a slave to craving or a slave to restlessness. You cannot really rest, right? That's what restless means, quite literally. There is no rest if you are restless, and you are being driven around in this way. And then one day you find the way out of that restlessness, largely by overcoming the craving that drives it. And then again, of course, you feel glad and full of joy. You sit down to meditate. You feel no craving anymore. You feel nothing is driving your mind around. You feel peaceful. You feel like you just want to sit still, right? Don't want to go anywhere else. There's a sense of contentment there. And you start to see how beautiful it is to be fully content and happy in the present moment. Nothing else to do. Nothing else you want to do except sit there. You feel like this rock of contentment. Nowhere, nothing else to do but sitting there. Okay. Or suppose a man with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert. But later on he would cross over the desert safe and secure with no loss to his property. Then, on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. And this is the idea here. This is about having doubts, right? When you have a lot of doubt about things, it's like you are in a desert. There is nothing. It's like it's very dry. It's barren. There's nothing there to feed you, nothing to sustain you, nothing to make your life worthwhile. It is like a dry piece of land, dry piece of existence. And this is, I think, elsewhere in the suttas, the Buddha has this idea where he says, after his awakening, he says, what should I now revere? What should I respect after this awakening experience? And it's a kind of a strange thing. You think that somebody who has awakened, there's no need for them to revere or respect anything in particular. And then he says that anyone who hasn't got anything, something to revere and respect in this world, something to be devoted to, they live in suffering. Right? They live in suffering because there's nothing to sustain you in life. There's no kind of water to keep you going, nothing to give life meaning, if you like. And when life doesn't really have any deeper meaning, it feels dry, it feels empty, it feels as if you're going through a desert where there's nothing to sustain you and kind of give you some sense of hope that actually there is something to life that is purposeful. And it's fascinating that even the Buddha says this. Even the Buddha was looking for something to sustain him, because he says that otherwise, if I haven't got this, then life, you live in suffering if you haven't got that. And then the Buddha, of course, says after that, well, what I will revere, what I will be devoted to, what I will respect, will be this very Dhamma that I have awoken to. That will be what I will revere in this life. So fascinating that even the Buddha wants to have something that he can kind of respect, right? There's nobody else he says I can respect because nobody else has awoken to the same truth that I have. But at least the Dhamma that I have found, I can respect that. So we should be happy in a sense that we have found something in our life that we feel is worthy of revering, worthy of respecting, because it enriches life. You don't have to walk through this desert anymore. The modern deserts are the shopping malls, right? They are the modern deserts. No spiritual values, nothing meaningful. It's just terrible. It's just materialistic thing, one thing after the other. And after a while, you start to feel empty inside. You feel like it's pointless. There's nothing really to it at all. So that is the problem with materialism. It's interesting, in some countries in the world, like, you know, where I come from originally, from Norway and Sweden and some of the Scandinavian countries, these are very atheistic countries. Nobody has faith in anything. People, the only thing they have faith in is kind of materialist things, basically. There's no Christ. People often ask me, oh, you come from Norway, maybe you are Christian. And if you're from Norway, you are nothing. You have no religion at all. These countries, no religion kind of disappeared out the window a long time ago. There's a few Christians, but only a tiny minority, 5-10%, something like that. And what happens in these countries, the most atheist countries in the world, what happens is that people need something, right? You need to have something to sustain you. Otherwise, again, you go into this desert. And a lot of people in those countries, they have actually a very high percentage, have a lot of respect for the Buddhist teachings. Because the Buddhist teachings are some of the things that are most easy to integrate with a modern worldview. Whereas a lot of other teachings are very difficult to integrate with a modern worldview. And I remember I think Ajahn Brahm told me this again. I get so much from Ajahn Brahm, so I keep on parroting Ajahn Brahm all the time. But Ajahn Brahm said that there was a survey done in Sweden. Sweden is like the neighboring country to Norway. Survey done among high school students. And they asked these high school students, okay, we know that you are atheist. Everybody's atheist in this country. We know that. But even so, if you had to choose a religion, right? What religion would you want to choose? Okay, Christianity, you know, one, Islam, one, Judaism, Hinduism, whatever, Buddhism. And the interesting thing was that 60%, right? 60% of these young people, these were high school students, if they had to choose a teaching, it would be Buddhism that they would choose. Which is very interesting because it shows that we have a lot of good PR, a lot of goodwill out there, right, as Buddhists. So there is a lot of kind of positive things going about these things. But we have to be careful because good PR is lost very, very quickly. And sometimes when you look around the Buddhist world, you see a few of the things going on. You think you have to be very careful unless you're going to lose all that goodwill. A little bit too much nationalism among the Buddhists, a little bit too kind of incorporating the Buddhist teachings into kind of expressions of nationalist sentiment and these kind of things, it doesn't take long before everything kind of gets spoiled by the ordinary human defilements that you find everywhere else. But so far, so good. And so that is a little bit about this importance of having something, right? Having this kind of crossing the desert, not having any doubts anymore. And of course, that doubt, then eventually it comes down to just the very simple thing of understanding the difference between wholesome and unwholesome states. So then you feel glad and joyful again. Every time you feel glad and joyful. And then it says, so too, bhikkhus, when these five hindrances are unabandoned in himself, a bhikkhu sees them respectively as a debt, a disease, a prison house, slavery, and a road across a desert. But when these five hindrances have been abandoned in himself, he sees that as a freedom from debt, healthiness, release from prison, freedom from slavery, and a land of safety. So now you are all in the land of safety. It feels good, doesn't it? So that is at least a little bit of safety, and then that safety increases the more you practice. And for that reason, we cannot stop here. We have to keep on going so that we can kind of move on to the next patch of safety. So now we're going to move on to the Satipatthana Sutta. Usually I don't teach the Satipatthana Sutta, but it's actually a very interesting sutta in so many different ways. And very often I feel the way that it is taught is very often not really entirely complete or perhaps even entirely satisfactory sometimes. Because Satipatthana is quite complex and you need to have a good overview of the object, of the subject, to really know exactly what is going on. So there's a number of, first of all, of course, when we come to Satipatthana, we are dealing with the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, Sammasati, right? And to understand what this is about. Now, one of the things that you will often hear about Satipatthana in the world is that Satipatthana Sutta is one of the most important suttas in the Pali Canon, right? This is very often what you will get to hear. And I think I've mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. And the question then has to be, well, why is it the most important sutta in the Pali Canon? Who has decreed that it is the most important sutta in the Pali Canon? Who has the authority to say these kind of things? The only person I know who has authority to do that must be the author of the sutta, right? Who is the author of Satipatthana Sutta? It's the Buddha. So we have to ask the Buddha. So you can't really ask him directly because he's not around, right? So what we have to do is again look at the suttas and see if the suttas have any kind of hierarchy as to which suttas are more important or not. And one of the things that we were talking about early on, for those of you who haven't been here all the time, is what the Buddha says in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. As he is about to pass away, he talks about those things that are the core issues in his teachings, right? And what he says in there is that the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, the 37 factors or qualities on the side of awakening, these are the things that are the core teachings that should be learned by the monks, should be reflected upon by the monks, should be practiced by the monks, and then, of course, be passed on down the generations to the next generation, and so on, all the way down to KL, 2,500 years later on, right? So here we are, still learning about the Bodhipakya Dhammas. And, of course, the four Satipatthanas we're talking about now are precisely some of those Bodhipakya Dhammas. So what we can say then is that these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, they are, in a way, the crucial aspects to remember. And the vast majority of suttas in the Pali Canon that you find, somehow they are incorporated into those 37 aids to awakening. Four Satipatthanas there are too. So all of this is there. So apart from that, the Buddha doesn't really single out any one teaching as more important than the other ones. They're all roughly equally important. They're all equally important, and also there's none that is not important and none that is more important than the other ones. They're roughly all on the same level. And the same is also true for the Satipatthana Sutta. It doesn't really need to be singled out as something very special. But there is, of course, a thing, and this is what happens, I think, in Buddhism. It happens everywhere around the world, in all kind of whatever society you're in. That things tend to go through fashions, right? You go through a period where everybody's practicing samatha practice, and people say, "Nah, samatha is no good." Now vipassana practice, right? Satipatthana, and then not satipatthana, metta practice, or whatever else, samatha practice again. Things tend to get into fashions. And these fashions, I think, are often because we tend to be like a little bit like sheep, right? People are a bit like sheep. There is a leader, and then everybody goes bah and follow after the leader. Yeah, yes, sir, we believe what you say and follow after the leader. This is just the nature, I think, of humanity. We go through fashions. Everybody, you know, if you look at people, everybody wears the same kind of glasses at a certain time or the same kind of clothes, right? Everywhere around the world, everybody does the same thing. And everybody following along in kind of in lockstep without thinking for themselves. Actually, monks are pretty bad too. We all look exactly the same. We all have the same haircut, right? So we're also just following, following certain fashions in a way, yeah. So, this is important to sometimes be independent, to step a little bit back and ask oneself, is this really reasonable? And when I step back and I look at these things, I see the Satipatthana Sutta as neither less nor more important than any other sutta in the Pali Canon. But that makes it important, right? Because every sutta is important in a sense. Now, the second thing is to understand what Satipatthana really is about. What is the purpose of Satipatthana? Very often we will, you know, you will hear that Satipatthana practice is all about insight, right? It's all about vipassana. That's the kind of thing that you will hear. And of course, there is some truth to that. It is not entirely false, of course. But the first thing to ask is, what does vipassana actually mean? Usually, vipassana is usually translated as insight into English, but the word insight, if you look up what it actually means in the English language, it is very similar to wisdom. When you get insight into something, when you see things fully, it means that you have wisdom about that. You know what's going on. But in Pali, vipassana is not the same thing as panya. Panya is really wisdom in the Pali language. Vipassana is that which leads to wisdom. And so I think a more appropriate translation of the word vipassana would be something like clear seeing. Right? Vipassana. Passana comes from the word to see anyway. And V is like having a bit of discrimination, having a little bit of understanding about what you're seeing as well. So clear seeing, I think, is very close to the actual meaning of vipassana. And if you see how the word vipassana is used in the suttas, always used together with samatha. Samatha vipassana is a compound used together all the time. And what is more, samatha and vipassana, these are two qualities that are strengthening all the time as you go through the path. The more, whatever you do on this path, it should always lead to more samatha and vipassana. And because these two qualities are strengthening as you go along the path all the way, can't really mean insight, right? You're not having insights all the time. You don't get insights just because you keep the five precepts. But what you do get when you keep the five precepts, you get more clear seeing because you are reducing the defilements in the mind. It means you see more clearly. And because you are reducing the defilements in the mind, you also have more calm, right? So this is one of those significant things about the Buddhist path, is that calm and clear seeing, samatha and vipassana, are two things always conjoined with each other. Yeah? You will always hear this from some of the greatest meditation masters, people like Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher in Thailand. He would say, it's like a knife, right? A knife has two sides. One side is samatha, the other is vipassana. They always have to go together. Otherwise, you have a one-sided knife. Right? Have you ever seen a one-sided knife before? It doesn't have the other side, only one side. It's like one of those Zen koans, a one-sided knife, only one side. So it is impossible. Once you have one side of something, you have to have the other side as well. So why is it the case that these things have to go together? And the answer is very simple. It is because both clear seeing and the calm of the mind come from the same cause. They come from the same condition. And that cause which leads to both clear seeing and calm is a reduction in the defilements. As the defilements go down, you feel more peaceful, right? Because the defilements are what drives the mind around, which makes you feel restless, which kind of makes you look into the future, look about into the past, the anger, the desire, and these kind of things. So once that calms down, when that becomes less, you feel more calm because there's less things to drive you into the future and into the past. But you also see things more clearly. And the reason you do that is because these things, these defilements, are the things that distort our outlook. They are the things that kind of make us think about things in the wrong way, give us vested interest, do things that are bad, that distort our vision of reality. So as the defilements go down, as you practice this path, gradually both samatha and vipassana have to rise together, just as a knife always has to have two sides. Yeah, so they come, they have the same cause. Because they have the same cause, they have to arise together as you practice the path. And it starts from the very beginning. Start keeping the five precepts, start being more kind-hearted, start restraining the senses through wisdom, not through willpower, right? Restraining those a little bit, reducing the defilements through watching the breath or whatever it is. Every stage of the path, every time you go one step further, these things disappear a little bit more. You have more samatha, you have more vipassana as a consequence, both arising together. So, satipatthana then. We have now seen how satipatthana is about reducing the five hindrances, right? How it fits into the gradual training where the five hindrances are. And satipatthana is very clearly about abandoning the five hindrances. So if it is about abandoning those hindrances, it must be about giving rise to both samatha and vipassana, right? Both calm and clear seeing must arise as a consequence of doing satipatthana practice. That is, if you do it right. If you do it wrong, nothing is going to happen, of course. But if you get it right, it's all going to come as a consequence. So this is how it works. So if you look outside of the Satipatthana Sutta and you look at how Satipatthana is talked about in the suttas outside of this, you get some clarity about how what its function is on the Buddhist path. And we have now just seen that right effort comes all the way up to Satipatthana, and then Satipatthana kind of takes off after right effort. So first of all, we have to abandon those worst defilements of the mind before we can start abandoning the refined ones in Satipatthana. Once Satipatthana has been practiced, the next step on the Noble Eightfold Path is right samadhi, right? Samma samadhi is the next step, which is the jhanas. So because the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path are all linked to each other, it means that Satipatthana, where it is taking you to samadhi. Right? That is where it's heading. Satipatthana comes from right effort, the abandoning of the hindrances and problems. Then you do the watching the breath or whatever, and then that takes you to samadhi, takes you to the jhanas. And this is something that if you know the sutta as well, it is something that is everywhere in the suttas. The idea of practicing mindfulness in the right way, taking you to samadhi as a consequence. Yeah, so this is, in many ways, the main purpose of Satipatthana. You find that in the five spiritual faculties, right? You start off with saddha leading to virya, virya to mindfulness to samadhi, samadhi to panya, mindfulness then samadhi, one following after the other. You find it in the seven factors of awakening, right? Seven factors of awakening, starting off with sati sambhojanga, leading all the way to samadhi sambhojanga and upeka sambhojanga. Sati being the foundation for samadhi. You see it on the Noble Eightfold Path. We've just been seeing that now. Basically, it is everywhere in the suttas. It is something that you cannot avoid. So this gives us a very good foundation for understanding. And mindfulness, understanding its purpose, understanding if we're practicing it properly, that it should move us towards samadhi in this way, coming from right effort via sati and then go into samadhi afterwards. So with that basic information as a background, understanding how this works, if you have any questions about this later on, please ask or ask now or whenever, really, whenever you feel like it, that's perfectly okay. But I think with that as a foundation, we can probably start to look at the Satipatthana Sutta, these what I call the applications of mindfulness, Majjhima Nikaya number 10. And it goes as follows. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Kuru country, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kamasa Dhamma. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus. "Bhikkhus, venerable sir," they replied, "the Blessed One said this." So first of all, here we are in the Kuru country. Do you know where the Kuru country is? Kuru country is in India. I'm just trying to wake you up a little bit. So it is in the area where New Delhi is now, roughly. It is toward the western side of India. So it is kind of on the outskirts where the Buddha would normally walk. Usually the Buddha would walk around the Ganges plain, that area. He would very rarely walk so far west. But this is one of the rare occasions where he goes to the Kurus and teaches the Satipatthana Sutta. There is one other version of the Satipatthana Sutta in the Nikayas. You know where that is? Yes? You know? Two, right? Exactly, that's right. It's in the Digha Nikaya number 22. It's called the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. So, what is interesting about the Maha Satipatthana Sutta is that when you read it, guess where that was given? You know where it was given? Kurus. Kamasa Dhamma, exactly the same place as the shorter one, right? Which is kind of strange, because here we are at the very outskirts of the Buddhist area, a place where he would go very rarely, where maybe he only had a few disciples, and this is where he then is supposed to have taught exactly the same teaching, in exactly the same place, and not in any of the kind of major places where he used to be. The more intelligent people, okay, so that is the sub-commentary, it says there are more intelligent people in the Kuru, that's why he had to teach it there twice, okay. But there is an alternative explanation, you see. That's only one explanation. That's what I call the dodgy explanation. What was that? No, this is what she's saying. I'm not saying that. Okay, here, right, so this is why we're doing the Satipatthana Sutta here. Okay, that's a good idea. That's a good point. You're probably right about that, actually. Yeah. So, conceit, that's right. So, the point is, and that is what is interesting about this, that is in the other transmissions of the Dhamma, you find the Agamas in Chinese and this sort of thing, there is only one Satipatthana Sutta. It's only in the Pali that you find it twice like this. So it's very likely that what has happened is that it has been copied and has then been transferred. So there's one version in the Digha Nikaya and one in the Majjhima Nikaya. And this kind of makes sense because the idea, remember the way the system of transmitters work in the Pali tradition. You have these things called the Banakas. A Banaka means a speaker, and it is a speaker of the Dhamma. And these Banakas, these were monastic fraternities, would meet together, and they would recite certain suttas together to ensure that the suttas were transmitted properly to the next generation. That's what the Banaka tradition is all about. And there were different Banakas that specialized in different Nikayas. So you had the Sangyuta Banakas, you had the Anguttara Banakas, and because they specialized in each Nikaya, every Banaka fraternity wanted to have the main sutta as part of their fraternity. In the Digha Nikaya, there was nothing about Satipatthana, right? Nothing there. Okay, whack it in there. And then we have it in the Digha Nikaya as well. Because these are containers. The Nikayas are containers that contain suttas. And because they are containers, they are quite flexible as to the content. You can move the suttas around. If you compare the Agamas in Chinese translation, you compare those with the Pali's, you see the suttas are often placed in different Nikayas, different agamas. So you may find that in the what is the Madhyama Agama in Chinese, many of the suttas there are found in the Anguttara Nikaya in the Pali or the Samyutta Nikaya in the Pali. They're not found in the same collection. So these are moved around because they're just containers like that. So this seems to be the most likely reason why this sutta was recited twice, because it was moved, copied and moved around in this way. And this is still happening in the present day. What is interesting, Satipatthana Sutta occurs, right? Remember, these suttas are passed down in different countries, right? You have the Burmese version of the Pali Canon, Thai version of the Pali Canon, the Sri Lankan version of the Pali Canon, and many, many other versions as well. And these versions of the Pali Canon are not always exactly the same. They are very close, but not always exactly the same, right? A bit of a worry, right? A bit of a concern. Oh, which one is right? So the answer, what is going on there is that suttas always get slightly corrupted over time. Somebody who transcribes it and writes it down makes a little mistake or whatever, and then that mistake they make may have a meaning, right? Because they kind of change the word letter T with the letter D or something like that. And that has a different meaning. And then that new meaning becomes passed down. And in this way, sometimes there may be slight changes in how this in the meaning of the suttas. And one of the big changes that was done in the Burmese tradition was that in the Burmese tradition, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta exists both in the Digha Nikaya and also in the Majjhima Nikaya. But if you read many of the other traditions, they only have a shorter version of the Satipatthana Sutta. They're not exactly the same length. So at some stage, it looks like the long version of the Satipatthana Sutta has been copied by the Burmese from the Digha Nikaya into the Majjhima Nikaya. It can't hurt, right? You're just adding a bit of material. It's already there. It's not a big deal. And this is kind of the way you rationalize how to kind of change things slightly, because you're just adding something. It's already part of the sutta. Doesn't make much difference. But the problem is that if you do rationalize those things, over time, it may actually have an effect on how you understand the material. So if there only was one mindfulness sutta originally, and then it became two, that has the effect of later generations who are not aware of that. They think that the Satipatthana Sutta is especially important because it occurs twice. They don't remember, they don't know that actually it was copied, 1,000 years ago by whoever and put into the Digha Nikaya. So these are some of the effects on this. This is why it is interesting there to notice that it is spoken to the Kurus twice. I apologize. If you find this incredibly boring what I'm talking about now, then I do apologize. But I think it is important to have some clarity about the suttas, and that there is always a little bit of corruption going on, and these things are important to be aware of that. We don't have 100% exactly the word of the Buddha anymore. What we have is something which is very close, and close enough for practical purposes. Okay. So that is the introduction on the Kurus. The Kurus are also very important in the Brahmanical literature. They talk about the Kurus. That's where the Brahmins, ancient Brahmins, came from. They hailed from that area. It was an important part, cultural area for the Brahmins of that time. And going back to the Upanishads and the Brahmanical suttas. So anyway, now we come to some bit more meat, a bit more real practical things. Because this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for the attainment of the true way, for the realization of extinguishment, namely the four applications of mindfulness. So I have added application, that's my translation, right? I've kind of taken out Bhikkhu Bodhi's word and added it in my own word. This is how you distort the suttas over time. So you see, I am no better than anyone else. I'm equally dodgy in the way I deal with these things. Bhikkhu Bodhi's here is the four establishments of mindfulness. I have added application there instead. Anyway, so I'm giving... Sir? Foundation. Bhikkhu... Okay, maybe it is foundation in this one, but Bhikkhu Bodhi is later translation in the Sangyutta is establishments. Yeah, so always new things, right? Always changing here. Makes it very hard. Ajahn Brahm often calls it the four focuses of mindfulness. And they all have slightly different meanings, right? They all kind of give slightly different ideas. If you say the four foundations of mindfulness, it sounds like the thing upon which mindfulness is based, and you build up mindfulness on that. If you say the four focuses or the four applications of mindfulness, it means that mindfulness is already there and now you apply it to something else. It's a different feeling here. The four establishments of mindfulness, again, is slightly different again. It is four ways, perhaps, of establishing mindfulness. And I'm going to explain to you why I have chosen this particular translation. Of course, it is because I believe it is more precise and more accurate. And I'm going to show you in a second why that is the case. But before that, we're going to have a break because time is going very fast. So, actually, maybe let's stop there because it's almost 3 o'clock already. And let's kind of continue with this paragraph when we come back after a break. So let's have a short break and we'll see you again 3:15 here.